Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And it is Halloween week.
It is.
And in honor of that, we are going to be covering a dark and sinister aircraft of the night that I honestly didn't think we would ever cover on our podcast.
No, it's a surprising one for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that aircraft is the Northrop P-61 Black Widow. Oh man, I like I said, I've been waiting for this one.
Yeah.
All October. So our pilot that we're covering today is Eugene Axtell, and unfortunately, we could not find a whole lot of information about his life. I mean, we know when he was born and when he passed away, but
that's about it.
Yeah, we don't know his early life, and we don't know what he did after the war. So we know that Eugene was born on April 8th, 1915, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Obviously served in the U.S. Army Air Force during World War II and would eventually pass away on February 2nd, 1978 in Huntsville, Alabama. So, you know, who knows? Maybe one day we'll get more information and we can do a part two of this episode.
Right.
But without further ado, we'll hop into his military career. So Eugene Axtell was transferred to the 422nd Night Fighter Squadron in April of 1944. And by August, the 422nd had been transferred to the European theater and was one of the first, I think the first night fighter squadron under the 9th Air Force.
Right.
So pretty cool. But he got his first taste of action on August 4th, 1944. And it was actually his first probable, they couldn't confirm it, but it was a probable kill against a German Dornier DOT, 217. And we should probably mention right now, he's got a kind of a cool lineup of kills.
He does, and a lot of the aircraft he fought against were night fighters, and the Germans just had a huge array of night fighters,
yeah.
The 217s, the 219s, the 88s, so on.
Yeah,
so.
I love the 219s?
Yeah,
the
Owls.
Hopefully I can make it out to the Smithsonian one day and see the one. I think they just put it back together.
Yeah, so that'd be really cool.
That's cool. And then, about 14 days later, he got his second probable kill against a Ju-188. And then for the viewers listening, it's kind of weird. The Germans had the Ju-88, which was, you know, around, I think, a medium fight. The Germans called them heavy fighters.
Heavy fighters, yep.
Yeah, like the Bf-110 and obviously the Ju-88. But the Ju-188... I know the cockpit structure was a little different. Do you know kind of
wing
more?
Design was a little more pointed.
Yeah.
Basically a little larger too.
Yeah. But they look super futuristic.
They do.
They're cool looking planes. Don't think there's any surviving that I know of.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. They remind me kind of a bat.
Almost, yeah.
The way their wings shaped.
It's a good description of it. Let's see here. So in October of 1944, he got into a bar fight, and it must've been a pretty bad bar fight cause he broke his leg. And he went on leave not too long after that to recover, which, now that I think about it, we had a scrappy bloomer who got into a bar fight in our North Dakota Aces series, and now Eugene Axtell got into a bar fight in our Minnesota Aces.
Right.
So we'll see if one of our South Dakota guys got into a bar fight when we get to that bridge.
Or if the Minnesotans can outdo the North Dakotans here and have a second
one. We'll see. and then he finally got his first and second confirmed kills in a single night on December 26th, 1944, against two more Ju-188s. So a little late Christmas present for the Germans.
And a double night, too.
I know.
Yeah.
And I think we have to remind the viewers, these are at night.
Yeah.
In 1944, like, just using, you know, the most early nose-mounted radar in some of these, you know, prop-driven planes.
And you had a radar guy in the back of the airplane, so the communication was kind of was weird. Just a sidebar here. The P-61s were sent to Europe were equipped without a turret, so that you didn't have a gunner. So all these gunners that were attached to the squadron were transferred to other squadrons with P-70s and other aircraft. And then the radar operator would sit back there, here in the back, originally. So you wouldn't even know if your guy bailed out or anything, because there's no communications between the two other than a Gosport tube, I believe, or intercom. And later on, they did move the radar operator closer to the cockpit, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should mention that, you know, the first P-61s that would have been delivered were A models. So, you know, the lessons they learned in Europe would eventually be transferred to the B and C models that, you know, saw extensive combat in the Pacific.
Yep.
And, you know, obviously helped the Allies win the war there. I did think it was kind of interesting. Pilots and radar observers on these planes shared kills.
Right.
So what would be really cool, unfortunately we just don't know it, I assume it was kind of like, you know, F-4 crews in Vietnam,
right,
where you didn't always fly with the same guys. You switched it
they
up.
They did, yeah.
But it'd be kind of cool to see, you know, who was the radar observer for Eugene's kills that are confirmed, at least.
Right.
So, let's see. His third kill came on January 1st, 1945, against a Ju-88, and it was kind of cool. It was the first American kill of 1945. It occurred at 0300 hours, so literally almost, what, just 2-3 hours after
the
New Year.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. He did receive a Distinguished Flying Cross in March of 1945, and we were able to find out that he earned 3 of them. So
yeah, and couldn't track each one.
Yeah.
To a specific mission, but yeah, he 2 oak leaf clusters on top of the first.
So. Very impressive. His fourth kill came on April 10th, 1945, when he shot down a Ju-52 transport, and the following night scored another kill against a Ju-52, thus becoming an ace. Even though if the his first 2 kills had been confirmed, he would have been an ace quite a while ago.
Right.
And after that, he was transferred out of the squadron in June 1945 after the war in Europe ended. Unfortunately, like we said at the beginning, that's where our history of Eugene goes cold. But if we were ever able to find more information about him, we'd love to follow this up with a part of the podcast. So now we get into the meat of this episode, and that is the history of the 422nd Fighter, or excuse me, Night Fighter Squadron. I was able to find that the 422nd went on to have another very impressive military career after the war. They were actually reassigned to Nellis and took over the F-111 Aardvark training program there.
Yes.
Which, if you are following me on Instagram, you know I just got done covering the whole Nellis Air Force Base history, so kind of a cool tie-in there. But the 422nd was activated on August 1st, 1943, and they were originally assigned to Orlando Army Air Base in Florida. Now, kind of cool, this is really testing our listeners' knowledge of American night fighters. They were initially trained on the Douglas P-70 Havoc night fighter. Now, I know you and I know what the P-70 is because we actually have a picture of one
right
at the Fargo Air Museum in our archives, which is, that was my first experience of what a Havoc or a P-70 was. But although later in the fall of 1943, they began to test early prototypes of the P-61 Black Widow. They could have been YP-61s, which were the first 2 prototype models. However, it's more likely that they were XP-61s, which were,
just test versions.
Test versions, exactly. Excuse me. In January of 1944, the training was interrupted for night fighting when they moved from Florida to Hammerfield in California. And after the relocation, the squadron completed training in March of 1944. So a little setback, but they were able to get back on track with no problem. So the 422nd was transferred then to the 9th Air Force in England, and interestingly, was the first night fighter squadron under the 9th Air Force, and they were assigned to RAF Charmy Down, and would eventually become the home of, on paper, 3 night fighter squadrons, but in actuality, they were only able to equip 2 at full strength. The 424th was one left behind in the United States for training duties. It's on par with, kind of the story of, new aircraft being delivered. I've seen it in my research all the time. When they arrived in England, there were actually no P-61s for them to fly, to train on, for maintenance guys to get their hands on. So since there were none available, what the 422nd did was they kept their flight time up by flying Cessna UC-78 Bobcats. Again, kind of an airplane you really don't hear much about.
Bamboo bomber.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, so. Little liaison kind of aircraft. And they also would practice flying with British-made de Havilland Mosquitoes borrowed from our friends in the Royal Air Force. Force.
And interestingly enough, it was kind of a common opinion in the high command of the European Air Forces, or the U.S. Air Force, Army Air Forces in Europe, that the P-61 was too slow and too unmaneuverable, just looked bulky. And they actually did test evaluations against the Mosquitoes, which the U.S.
They
actually
had flown, yeah.
Flown and then ordered, or tried to order, and the RAF kept shooting them down because they needed them. Yeah. It was one of the only planes at the time that could get to Germany and back without getting shot down because it had the range and it had the speed and the altitude. So they ended up doing a test evaluation between, or a couple times, and the P-61 is found to be more maneuverable, surprisingly, just based off the looks.
Yeah, that is surprising.
And it had a better climb performance and wasn't actually faster than the Mosquito, but...
What do we know what engines powered the P-61?
This is a spitball. I apologize to anybody. I believe it was the R-2600s.
Gotcha. Still, powerful engine if you have two of them on there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you did have Merlins in the Mosquito, which are two great engines.
Yeah. Absolutely. And again, you know, it's cool to see. Obviously, we knew that American reconnaissance squadrons were flying the Mosquito at times. I think there actually is one on display at the Air Force Museum, which is kind of cool. But even using them for night fighter training. So the 422nd was moved to RAF Scorton. I think that's how you pronounce it. Please forgive me to our British listeners. On May 6, 1944. And, you know, that's actually exactly a month before Operation Overlord.
Right.
And I believe the original plan was to have three night fighter squadrons on combat status. You know, the Allies didn't know what the response was going to be.
Nope.
Obviously, Eisenhower had a note ready in case the invasion failed. That, you know, there could have been thousands of Luftwaffe fighters attacking the beachhead overnight. And having those Mosquitoes would have been an excellent way to defend the beachhead, or, you know, just kind of defend, you know, all the guys moving inward. But unfortunately, that wasn't to be. I don't even think they had the first P-61s available until the very end of May, with, you know, less than a week before the landings planned. So, that didn't come to fruition, unfortunately. But their first taste of combat in Europe was when, of all things, German V1 flying bombs were heading and, you know, striking targets in London and all over the British countryside. And the 422nd really got training by shooting down these unmanned rockets.
Right.
And we've seen the footage. I think, was it Hawker Tempests?
Tempests, Spitfires.
Like, just whatever they had that was fast enough to take these. Yeah.
Just tip them.
Well, and, you know, at when they were first engaging these V1s, they just shot them down like normal planes, but they didn't realize if they exploded, which they oftentimes did, if they flew through that, it might
end well.
Yeah, it was game over for them, unfortunately. So kind of interestingly, the first Black Widow V1 kill took place on July 16th, 1944, and was credited to pilot Hermann Ernst and his radar operator, Edward Kopsel, of the 422nd Night Fighter Squadron. And I laugh because I know we were talking before the podcast episode. I had to read that three times because I thought that crew was German.
Yeah, me too.
That is a very German-sounding crew. Interestingly, of course, they were both American, both, you know, American pilots, but that was they were the ones credited with the first kill. So on July 25th, 1944... that was officially when the squadron was considered operationally ready for night fighting or night interception, and was moved over across the English Channel to, forgive my pronunciation, Maupertu?
Sure, we'll go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with that. It's A-15. We'll call it A-15.
There we go.
In France. From A-15, the squadron then entered combat and began to perform night interception and intruding missions against German night fighters, night bombers, all the above.
Yep.
Pretty interesting stuff there. And I mean, you know, it's so hard to kind of get lost in, you know, the history of night fighting in World War II. I think were the Germans the first to really use it against, I think they used it against British bombers.
Early, yeah. They equipped BF-110s originally. And, I mean, you had night fighters everywhere. You had, if you know what the Defiant is, the turret fighter from the RAF, found to be terrible during the day, actually had some success at night against the Blitz, or during the Blitz and then slightly after.
Interesting. Because so. I know I've seen a few paintings or models of just all black Defiants. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen all black Hurricanes before, too. Yep. It looks cool.
It is, yeah, and it's just interesting, the technology. The book is called Ace, with an exclamation point. I forget who wrote it. It was an autobiography of a Hellcat Ace, night-fighting Hellcat Ace in the Pacific. And that was really interesting, how he had this really primitive radar. He ran the radar and shot down planes.
I was going to say, one of our North Dakota Aces was a night-fighter Hellcat Ace, mm-hmm. wasn't he?
He was actually a reconnaissance guy.
Okay, yeah, gotcha, right.
Just a kind of flying outside your role is kind of interesting. There you go. But yeah, it was really interesting that, you know, the night fighting stuff, like you said. I don't know a ton about it, but
yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, and then, you know, as the Allies found out, you know, after D-Day, the German air power was very much reduced to, you know, they underestimated they overestimated, I should say, how many German aircraft were still flying around and the quality of pilots and all that. We've talked about that. I remember in the Dunn podcast where, and in the book he wrote, he was expecting just a hellstorm of German aircraft, huge air battles, and didn't happen. But as the number of enemy night intruders, German aircraft, lowered, the squadron also performed a lot of interdiction attacks on forces in France. I know they were well involved in the Battle of Bulge, kind of pushing back the Germans there, and they actually moved eastward through a series of advanced landing grounds until they operated from captured Luftwaffe bases in Germany in the spring of 45. And then the squadron ended combat operations in May 1945 and became part of the Army of Occupation until August 1945. They demobilized in Europe, and aircraft were flown back to the United States for storage or use with post-war all-weather Air Defense Command interceptor squadrons, which the P-61s did serve for a couple more years.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a couple pictures of, obviously, they say U.S. Air Force. Usually, I think they flew from a lot of bases on the East Coast, mm-hmm. You know, from 47 until 1950. They didn't know if the Soviets were just like keeping the war going, and having those P-61s on standby, you know, even by, you know, the mid to late 1940s, you could make an argument that with, you know, jets like the F-80 or some of those early Russian designs, would the P-61 have been obsolete by that point?
Right, and who knows? I mean,
I couldn't find anything. Did P-61 see combat in Korea?
They did not.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it's one of those designs that didn't quite survive that that late 40s period of military history.
And I just, you know, we'll move on to our third and final part of this episode here shortly, but I just want to go back and talk, you have to imagine, you put yourself in the boots of a German grunt or whatever in the final months of the war, and, you know, you do all the blackout curtains, all mm-hmm. that, you're waiting to board a train, or, you know, you're taking trucks or tanks off of a train, and, you know, you think you're safe at night, and all of a sudden, just boom, chaos, and, you know, it gives me goosebumps, but you just see a low strafing all black aircraft come in, and you're like, what the schnitzel is that?
Right. It's just crazy how the air superiority just steamrolled. You know, help the Allies steamroll across Europe. I know it wasn't a cakewalk, but just the lopsidedness of it. And they're even using the P-61s during day missions, I saw.
Wow.
In this, our main source for this podcast episode actually was the 422nd Night Fighting Squadron history that was written during the war. And they did discuss, you know, Axel going out on some of these air interdiction missions during the day. And it's just, that would be odd, just seeing a P-61 against
all
a blanket
black.
Of snow.
Yeah.
No camo.
Yeah. That's a little out of place. again, fascinating history. The 422nd, I believe is either, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't know if they're still in use. I think They would go on to be F-111 squadron at Nellis, and they did weapons testing. So how to deliver, you know, air-to-ground munitions, I think both nuclear and conventional. I don't know if they're still in use. Unfortunately, I did not research that far, just because the 422nd had such an impressive World War II career.
Exactly.
So now we move on to our final part. And unfortunately, there are not a whole lot of P-61s left. There are only four known P-61s that survive today. There's one currently under restoration to airworthiness, which will be awesome when that is done. Another one is in China.
That was odd. And that was captured, more or less, when the communists forced the Americans out.
You would have thought that they would have scuttled them, but it sounds like they were, get out, leave the planes,
and
we won't kill you.
I saw records that they had three of them at some point, and they flew two of them, flew them, and two of them ended up crashing, which was the main, per se, killer of the P-61s was accidents.
That being said, there are, unfortunately, none of the four survivors are marked as 422nd aircraft. In fact, I don't think any of them are even European marked, unfortunately. We just, you know, that's to be expected. The P-61, I think, made a bigger name for itself in the Pacific theater, flying B and C models. But most of the A models that I found that were sent to Europe were reclaimed in Germany. So I think very few of the ones that were actually sent to Europe actually ended up making it back to the air defense squadrons. But that's not to say that a couple of A models might have been sent back for parts or something like that.
Right.
But in its place, we were actually able to find the P-61A that was assigned directly to Axtell, and I think it's so cool.
Oh, it is, yeah.
Of course, he nicknamed it Battle Axe.
Pretty cool
awesome.
Name.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, when your last name is Axtell, you got to include that somewhere. Yeah. So Axtell's was actually a very early P-61A, serial number 42-5568. So when you take into account how many aircraft were ordered by the U.S. Army Air Force in 1942, the numbers, I think, go up into the hundreds of thousands.
It's a small digit right there.
Yeah. It's it's very, very low if you know your Air Force, Army Air Force serial numbers. He flew it on several occasions. There's actually a couple of really cool photos of it online.
Right.
Which is, I think, super rare.
We have some cool options for our cover.
Yeah. If you're listening to this at this point, hopefully the cover is what drew you in, and hopefully it's the content that makes you stick around.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, a Battle Axe was written off in a crash at Florence, Belgium on March 5th, 1945. And must have been used as a part source because it wasn't reclaimed or scrapped in what we call it at
Army
Air Base in Germany on January 10th, 1948. So my guess is that it did serve as a part source. Probably was just sitting in a field or they just kept the airframe and took parts off of it, and then finally didn't get to it until 1948.
Exactly.
But unfortunately, all that remains of it is pictures, and it lives on, and now forever in this digital format of a podcast.
There we go.
That wraps up it wraps up this episode.
Exactly.
Again, we wish that we had more information on Eugene's life. Would love to be able to tell you guys that. But unfortunately, we'll just have to wait until, if there ever is a part two. Just looking at some of the notes we had, there is so much we could talk about night fighters in Europe.
It could go very long.
Absolutely. And, you know, that could be something we talk about.
Could just be a special.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, again, so surprising. Like, when we were, we've been kind of toying with the idea of starting this podcast series up for better part of a year, since we were kind of researching it during the for your Masters of the Air display here at the museum, and then came across just all these pilots and going through the lost records and whatnot, and then found this guy. I don't remember which one of us did, but
I think it was
surprising.
Yeah.
You know,
And, you know, it's like Minnesota, not to obviously bash our North Dakota Aces. Obviously, Minnesota had a much bigger population before and, you know, after the war, even to this day. But, you know, Minnesota will have, in the future, will have at least one Flying Tiger.
Exactly.
We have a P-61 Ace, a couple.
Guadalcanal, we got.
Marine Corps.
Everything is just
We have a lot. And obviously, we wanted to put this one out for Halloween.
It's a little spooky.
Yep, something spooky, a bump in the night, so to speak. I wish I could say that in German.
That'd be yeah.
Cool. But yeah, this is one that I was really looking forward to, and we hope the listeners enjoyed it. Again, we love putting these out, and as long as you guys keep listening, we'll keep doing them.
We have a lot of aces to cover in just the Minnesota series. Exactly. We got a lot to go.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, I know we've toyed with, you know, not exclusively doing aces. Like,
right.
You know, we could take a break and cover a good friend or a legendary pilot, maybe not an ace, but one that flew on an important mission or someone that was near and dear to our hearts.
And we got a couple that tie into the Air Museum for sure.
Absolutely. So without further ado, Sam, anything else?
No, that was fun. We're excited to bring this one to you, and hopefully we see you next week.
Absolutely. Well, have a great and safe, happy Halloween, and we'll catch you on the flip side.
We'll see ya.
See ya.